I was asked to give a colloquium and was given the choice of dates near the, well, they coincide with my visit, but at the beginning of the colloquium season, there wasn't any option as to what to give the colloquium on if you're a particle physicist. This is the hot news. I should try to give you some sense of what the hot news means, at least my interpretation of it. And my approach will be what might be described as fair and balanced. So those of you that are familiar with the Fox News will know that that's their motto, and they're anything but fair and balanced. But I'll try, kind of. Okay, so here's the outline of my talk. And, well, first of all, I have to talk a little bit about the data. I'm not an experimentalist. I'm a particle theorist. And so I'm basically going to tell you about two plots, from one from each of the ATLAS and CMS discovery papers that I think give you a good sense of what's going on. And I'll describe those. I'll take a little time to describe those. And you've probably heard that the statistical significance of this is 5 sigma. That's that is the standard by which particle physicists use to say that they've discovered a particle. And that's a really high standard. In terms of probability, the probability of a fluctuation outside, happening statistically, that would be outside of this would be 1 in 3.5 million. At least if I didn't integrate right yesterday. And if you ask for an up fluctuation, not both wings of the distribution, it's like 1 in 7 million. So that seems particularly odd, right? You know, 1 in 7 million things. We should lower our standards for discovery. That's ridiculous. Haven't these particle experimentalists ever played poker? It never happens. So we have to talk a little bit about that. And so you notice that I only have 19 slides in my talk. And I got 2 of them devoted to this 5 sigma. And only the first sentence of those 2 slides is something that people would call the real reason or the scientific reason for the 5 sigma. And the rest is just colorful things I've added to make you nervous. Okay, so what is this Higgs boson? I'm going to go over what role it plays within the standard model, what it is, what it does, why you need it. And then this talk really isn't about standard model physics per se. It's really about beyond the standard model physics, speculative ideas in particle physics. And speculative ideas can occur at any energy scale. They could occur at the Planck scale. They could occur at any other energy scale where we're doing physics now at the LHC at the weak scale, roughly 1,000 times the mass of the proton if you convert that mass into energy. And so we have to talk about what we know from data and from theoretical ideas about where new physics beyond what we understand might occur. So that itself is a speculative type of argument, but I'll go through that. And then we're going to finish off with just a few examples of beyond the standard model physics and their influence on properties of the Higgs boson, what it's telling about them. So I picked 3 pretty simple ones, none of which you've heard before. I picked some extra scalars, spin zero particles that have color, some extra leptons, and then one you've maybe heard about. You've probably heard about the Randall-Sundrum model, the Randall-Sundrum radian. If I have time, I might not have time for that one. Of course, the poster child for physics beyond the standard model is low-energy supersymmetry. And it's not that I'm going to leave that out, but I'm going to sprinkle, it's so important that I'm going to sprinkle my discussion of it in here. Okay, so there you go. I got 19 transparencies. A few of them are rather sparse, like one has a duck on it. So you'd think I'm going to finish this talk in 5 minutes. But shockingly, the older I get, the less I manage to say in a given talk. So usually I get through about 10 slides. So within a factor of 2, we should finish on time. No, the duck doesn't take too long. OK, so 19 slides. And here's my standard comment at this point, that As you go on through the colloquium, about here, a third of the audience is more concerned with how much is left than how much went before. And so I've got all the slides numbered, and we're heading for 19. Okay, so a new resonance has been discovered. I'm going to have two references to papers on this in this talk. That doesn't mean I'm responsible for most of the things I'm presenting here. Far from that, as far as you could possibly imagine, actually. But I'm more or less qualified for this discussion, so we're okay. So we have two papers here. I think September 17th is the official publication date. And they're in Physics Letters B. And they're by the two experiments, the two high-energy collider experiments, the one centered on Higgs-type physics at the LHC, ATLAS and CMS. And there is something to notice about these papers that really bothers me. And that's that, well, if you can, you can see that this one starts at page 1, this one starts at page 30. So they're 30-page long papers in PhysRev Letters, in Physics Letters. If I sent a 30-page paper to Physics Letters, I would get a rejection letter right away. So kind of annoys me. Maybe Stephen Hawking could get away with it, but everyone else in this room would get bounced right away. But nonetheless, I let this one through. Okay, so units. This Higgs has a mass of 125 GeV. When I quote masses, energies, I'm going to quote them in GeV. I'm going to use units where H bar and C are equal to 1. So 125 GeV, well, that's the energy and the rest mass of a proton, roughly. 1 GeV, sorry. So it's like 100 times, a little bit more, times the rest mass of a proton. And sometimes I'll mention a TeV, which is 1,000 GeV. And that's because the center of mass energy available is, on average, around 7 or 8 TeV for these experiments, the data I'm going to discuss with you. So the Higgs, this new boson, they don't call it a Higgs in here, although there it was a search for the standard model Higgs boson. They found a resonance there with a mass of 125 GeV. It's a resonance. We call it a particle in particle physics, but it's unstable. Almost all the particles we talk about are unstable. And if you talk about its lifetime, in these units I've discussed with H bar C equal to 1, it's about 1 over a GeV. That's a monstrously short lifetime. I've never really converted it into seconds. I'm guessing it's something like 10 to the minus 25 seconds. So even if you multiply it by the speed of the light, it's a pretty short distance. You're not going to see a displaced vertex. So you detect the Higgs, or they look for the Higgs, in its decay products. Sometimes it decays in something that's easy to see above the mush of everything else there. They're colliding protons. Protons, you know, they hit, and a lot of stuff comes out. So you've got to be able to see the final states amongst the stuff that comes out after you make certain cuts on energies and the like. So let's look at the channels, or the final states in which they find the Higgs. Let's just step through them for a minute or two. So if it is a Higgs and it has this mass, it decays mostly to a bottom quark and an anti-bottom quark. There's lots of quarks around. Protons and neutrons are made up of up and down quarks, and there's strange, charm, top, bottom, six quarks altogether. The bottom is the heaviest of the charge minus the third quarks. If it's the Higgs, it couples most strongly and therefore decays most often into the heaviest states available to it. Bottoms weigh about 5 GeV, so it doesn't violate energy conservation for it to decay to these. And so you could look for it in the BB bar state, bottom quark, anti-bottom quark. Of course, quarks interact strongly, and the strong interactions are confining. So in the end, we see states with no color, no net strong interactions. It's screened off. They're called hadrons. They're particles that are made up of a bottom quark and, for example, an anti-up quark to screen off the color. Then there's the heaviest of the charge leptons, electron, muon, tau, which you can also look for it. Then there's the analogs of the photon, the force carriers for the weak interaction, the charge W and the neutral Z. It's a little bit different than photons in the fact that they're massive. And in fact, the W's weigh about 80 GeV, so you can't really make two W's in these experiments. They don't see two W's. really they see the decay products of one of them, and it's what you call a virtual particle. It just appears as an intermediate state, doing perturbation theory when you try to calculate the rate for the reaction. And then there's the decay to two photons. And this is a pretty rare decay mode. The fraction of the time the Higgs decays to two photons is about 0.2% of the time. Pretty small fraction. While the B is most of the time. These are suppressed because they're very massive, because you don't make a real Z. You have to go through this intermediate state, which suppresses these somewhat. But this has a cleaner signal experimentally. It's easier for them to get a handle on it. And so the errors for looking for the Higgs in this mode will be smaller than this mode. So the uncertainty in the mass, it's a better than 1% measurement of the mass of this particle. It's about half a GeV. And this width is 1 over this is like the lifetime in these kooky units. And so that's about 1 GeV. And as I mentioned before, the statistical significance is greater than 5 sigma. And that's the benchmark for discovering a particle in particle physics and collider experiments. If you ask in dark matter experiments, what's the benchmark for having said they detect the dark matter, it's actually 3 standard deviations, 3 sigma. But we'll discuss this a little bit later. As I mentioned before, it's got a probability of about 1/3.5 million for a 5 sigma fluctuation to have occurred. And both experiments see it. Presumably, they're independent. They probably discuss it over drinks at the end of the day, but they're more or less independent. OK, so I got 2 plots, one from CMS, one from ATLAS. And what this is a plot of is it gives each of these possible decay modes, the ones they can observe, listed here. And then it gives the central value and the 1 sigma error bar. And here's 1 here. What it is the rate for making the Higgs times its branching ratio, the fraction of the time it goes into this mode, divided by what you'd expect in the standard model. So you want to see a 1 here if you want it to be the Higgs, the standard model Higgs. I'll explain to you what I mean by that in a moment. So the plots, the experimental plot paper, they got a lot of plots. I think this is figure 19. We're skipping right to figure 19, because as a theorist, this is what I care most about. I'm not qualified to speak about the other figures in any detail. OK, so here you see the gamma-gamma mode. It's a little bit high here compared to 1. And this is the 1 sigma error bar. The ZZ is completely compatible, the WW. Tau tau and BB, even though it decays most of the time to this, it's just harder to see. And you can see it's got a big error bar. You can see that CMS didn't see any taus, because this is centered at 0. But 1 standard deviation takes you almost to 1. And so I wouldn't get too nervous about that at this time. So that's the situation with CMS. If you average them all, you get a number here, the central line, that's a little bit less than 1. But the 1 sigma error bar includes 1. So that's basically comparing what they've seen to what you'd expect for a standard model Higgs. That's CMS. Don't worry about the stuff on the top, the units, like femtobarns, crazy stuff. This is the center of mass energy in these TeV, as I mentioned before, 1,000. TeV is 1,000 times a GeV, 1,000 times the rest mass energy in a proton. ATLAS, the other big experiment, similar type of plot. Here they were much more careful than my colleagues on CMS. Caltech has a CMS group, so I call them my colleagues. I hope they don't listen to this talk ever. But anyways, they put the W star here to remind us that it's not a real W. It's forbidden by energy conservation. And then they tell you what mode that the W is decaying, what they actually looked at in this plot, what goes into this plot here. And the one with a BB bar is so hard to see. Usually the Higgs, how you make it at the LHC, is some of the constituents of the proton. The proton's made of quarks. And also something called gluons, the analog of the photon, but for the strong interactions. Usually the dominant way you make the Higgs is you take a gluon from each proton, they interact, and they make the Higgs that then decays. That's the biggest rate. But because the bee is so hard to see, they need to have Higgses that weren't made that way. They were radiated off a W or a Z, and then this gives you other handles and how they decay. Anyways, it's very similar. Some errors are bigger, some are a little smaller. I didn't really go with a ruler to see if they're actually smaller, but anyways, I'm trying to be fair and balanced. Yeah, a little bit. Of course, we're going to talk more about that. But that's the thing that sticks out most, is that the gamma rate is higher than both experiments. And so the question is, how could this happen? What is this telling us? It's not so significant statistically, right? I mean, it could easily go away. But it's not within one sigma, and there are two experiments, independent experiments. So it's certainly something to think about, and so we'll think about it a little bit during this talk. In this case, the average actually comes out a little bit bigger than one. In the other case, it was a little bit less than one, but roughly, you know, within one sigma or a little bit more than one sigma, it's one. Okay, so that's the data, you know, at the level of a theorist discussing it. Really, I'm sure you'll have during the year some experimental talks where they do justice to it. But keep it, nothing too weird. Things look okay. Gamma is a little bit big in both experiments, or quite a bit big at the central value, but it's early days. And that will get better. It'll be better by Christmas time as far as the statistical error is going down. So how should we interpret this? Yeah?
So this is for a fixed peak mass, but presumably we could...
Well, they measure the mass of something. So if it is the Higgs, then this is what you expect. Yeah, so they've measured the mass. You know, those with four leptons, for example, give you a very precise, less than 1% error on the mass of this resonance. So assuming it is the Higgs, that gives you the one, and that's how I'm interpreting this. So is it the Higgs? Do I think it's the Higgs? So we have to have some, it's really a qualitative question, but here's what I think about that. If it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. It could be a space alien dressed in a duck suit, but it's probably a duck. So when you look to alternatives to the Higgs, if it's something incredibly convoluted, some complicated model in comparison to the standard model, so I have to go after the standard model, that's a space alien dressed in a duck suit. You know, if it's not so bad, looks nice, maybe that's a goose. That could be a goose. What the hell do I know about ducks and geese? So you have to have some judgment there. People have written papers recently about lookalikes, things that could imitate the Higgs. Probably the most reasonable of them, in quotes, is something you might call a dilettante or a radion. And if I have time, I'll talk a little bit about that at the very end of my talk. Okay, what's up with this 5 sigma, this 1 in 3.5 million, or for an up fluctuation, 1 in 7 million? Didn't those experimentalists ever play poker? You know, what were they smoking when they came up with this standard? It's crazy. Got to talk a little bit about that. Gee, no laughs for what were they smoking? I used that joke about, it must be 20 years ago now, when I was asked to give a talk at University of Chicago. It was a job talk. They were looking at me for getting a job. Needless to say, I did not get the job. I did not get any laughs. Yeah. Okay, here we go. So the real reason, the one that scientists, that experimentalists would say is, look, if you're searching for new particles, generically at a collider, you look at a lot of different distributions. You look for a bump, a mass peak in a lot of different places, maybe even 1,000 places. And so there's some sort of entropy factor, if you'd like. You know, things that happen that probabilistically should happen only 1 in 1,000 times, we get those all the time and they go away. So clearly we have to have a very high standard. And I don't know if there was actually a convention when the particle physicists came up with 5 sigma or how it happened, but that's the reason that most particle physicists would say that you want to go with Phi Sigma. Of course, in the case of the Higgs, they're looking for the Higgs. They're not looking at every distribution. That's what they're looking for. This doesn't really apply. But still, it comforts me greatly that it's 1 in 5 sigma. And I want that 5 sigma is the criterion. And I want to explain to you why it comforts me. So what follows, I have a little title for that, Stuff Happens. Or, if you like, it's the experimental hall of shame. So let's go through these a little bit. So the first one I'm going to, I just picked three. There's actually not that many. Experimentalists are really good, but here we go. There's the Zeta 8.3. In 1984, was it 83 or 84? In 1984, the Crystal Ball Collaboration, one of the most reliable experimental groups in history, they never made a mistake, discovered a new resonance in bound states of a bottom quark and an anti-bottom quark. They decayed to a photon plus this state. They looked at it two ways, significance greater than 5 standard deviations. They discovered the Zeta 8.3, the unicorn of particles. Took a little bit of while, it went away. Of course, it's not a statistical fluctuation. That's not the reason it goes away. You make all kinds of experimental cuts. You say you're only going to look here and there. You don't completely understand your background, and boom, there's a peak somewhere. Here's one I really like. Epsilon. In 1964, CP violation was discovered by the measurement of epsilon. A kaon is a bound state, a neutral kaon, of a strange quark and an anti-down. And also, you could have an anti-down with a strange. And these states here, if CP violation, if CP was conserved, are the linear combinations of those states, though this one with even CP, this with odd CP. They're spin zero, pi plus pi minus in a spin zero state, since it can't have any, they have spin zero, there can't be any orbital angular momentum, so they're CP even. And so this would be zero if CP was conserved, the parameter epsilon. And so it was measured in 1964, and it was measured after, I don't remember how many times, 5 or 6 times. And then the results were compiled, all the errors put together, and out came the best value of epsilon, 1.95 plus or minus 0.03, a pretty small error. And this is a ratio of decay rates, and so a lot of errors cancel out in a ratio of decay rate. Then, I think it was 1973, a measurement was done that yield. So all the results that were averaged, they were consistent with this central value. They had errors somewhat bigger than this, but they were all consistent with this central value. So in 1973, I believe it was, this an experiment was done that got a different central value outside of this error. And the experiments after that, if you average them, this was not the latest particle data books. I don't know if it is the latest data. But if you average them, you get this number, 2.25 plus or minus 0.03 times 10 to the minus 3. That's a lot of sigmas between here and here with that error. What can I say? Stuff happens. Experiments are hard. Well, to bring a little local color to the discussion, we could discuss Simpson's neutrino, discovered in 1985 in Guelph, not far down the street. And it was a neutrino with a mass of about 17,000 electron volts. And the electron neutrino was supposed to be about 10% this neutrino. And it took a long time to refute this. It wasn't convincingly refuted till about sometime in the 1990s. I don't remember precisely when. I didn't bother to look it up. I do remember it very well because I held off writing a paper on this. I held off writing a paper. And then John Presco, my colleague at Caltech, and I wrote a paper like the day before it was refuted. So it's burned into my soul. Anyways, I don't want to give you the wrong impression about experimentalists. Experiments are hard. They're really good. My experimental colleagues, these things are very rare. They're not the typical thing. We've discovered a new resonance. It's probably the Higgs boson, but I like the fact that we wait till it's 5 sigma for this reason. The number of these things are much greater, of course, if you lower the bar for what you call a discovery. Okay, so I got, yeah? Well, sigma is a sigma is a statistical error. And, well, it includes an estimate of systematics, but you can just make a mistake. All of these are mistakes. There was a background they didn't understand. So it's not in what they've misestimated the uncertainty. And some of them are just real mistakes. You just created the peak by, it's a false peak by doing things, and you didn't appreciate that those things could happen. Mistakes. Mistakes happen. Okay, so I want to now go on to the Higgs boson and the Standard Model. So this is going to be a little bit, if you're a part, this is a, this, I'm trying to, I'm not the most pedagogical of speakers. That's why I was chosen as one of the lecturers for the school here. But I'm trying here in this next few slides to be pedagogical. So if you're a particle physicist, a real jock, then you'll be a little bit bored. But we're trying here. Okay, so I'm going to use the language of perturbation theory a lot. And in perturbation theory, if you go beyond leading order, you get sums over intermediate states. And in particle physics, we usually pick the unperturbed Hamiltonian to be one of free particles, because we can solve free particles exactly. Free means they don't interact at all. Just label them by a momenta, and that describes the state. Well, that's not a normalizable state. So if you want to, so let's put them in a, put the particles in a box, side of length L, giant box. L is huge. We're all caged in the box, but we don't know it, so we're happy. So the sums over intermediate states, so the momenta of these particles that are related to n in this way, and the sums involve sums over n1, n2, and n3, and delta n, the spacing in n is 1, so I could put a delta n cubed, and for L really large, we're obviously dominated by large n if we want to get any kind of p, and so you take this over and convert it to an integral in this way, and so you talk about integrating over momenta when you do perturbation theory in particle physics. And then you got this L cubed. Don't worry about it. If L is huge, we could never know. And so if you do the calculation right, the L cubed is supposed to cancel out in the end. So we just won't worry about it. We'll just talk about shells of momenta. It should cancel out in the end. So I want to talk about the Higgs boson and the Standard Model. I got to tell you a little bit about the principles on which the Standard Model is based and what it is. So it's really an extension of electromagnetism is the best way to think of the Standard Model. So electromagnetism, if you're going to think of it as having a principle behind it, it's the principle of gauge invariance. So what is gauge invariance? Well, you take the photon field, the four vector potentials. So E and B, the real things that are most closely connected to what you measure, are related to phi, which is A naught. And B, for example, is curl of A, the vector potential. So I've lumped them all together, four things. Mu goes over 0, 1, 2, 3, because they do form a four vector under Lorentz transformations. And you say you want your theory to have an invariance, where if you take A mu and you shift it by an amount like this, d mu of some function of space and time, then your action is invariant under this. The action is what determines the theory. In the path integral formulation, the measure is e to the I, the action over h bar, which is one for us. The path integral formulation of quantum mechanics. So right away, as soon as you say this, you know the photon has to be massless. It tells you the photon is massless. Because if I have a term like this, a mass term it ends up is, a mass term for any field is the field twice and no derivatives. Because when you derive the equations of motion, you have to remove one of the a's by varying with respect to a, and so it gives you a constant times the field in the equation of motion. And so in a dispersion relation, that acts like a mass term, a constant term, no factors of e or p. So this principle tells us right away that the photon should be massless if we're going to have this gauge invariance. Well, we want to have some action, so you got to be able to write something down. You know, electromagnetism dates back to Maxwell, so obviously those Brits figured it out at one point or another. And so F mu nu is an object that actually is invariant under gauge transformations, because if I transform both of these A's, I get d mu d nu of omega minus d nu d mu of omega, and partial derivatives commute. So this is something that's invariant under these gauge transformations that depend on space and time. And so here's a simple form of the action. It's the action that describes free photons, electromagnetism not coupled to any charges, no charges, free photons, pretty boring. You have one photon, two photons, three photons, its energy is its momentum. Time to leave. Free theories aren't that interesting, but you got to understand them first. So in particle physics, we talk about the fields, just like the classical fields, except we quantize them. They become operators. So here is the vector potential part. A is an operator. You can actually choose a gauge where A0 is 0. And you write it like this, some superposition. I've gone into this integral over momenta. Instead of labeling it by discrete states n, I've labeled them by these wave vectors or momenta. And it's just a superposition like this. This is a polarization vector. Photons have a polarization. There's two of them because you impose this condition, left-handed and right-handed, or you could use some other basis if you want. And then there's an operator that destroys a photon and an operator that creates a photon in the Hermitian conjugate, because this is a real operator, a Hermitian operator, if you'd like. So if you hear a talk by particle physicists, if it's an experimental talk, they talk about particles. If it's a theorist talking, they talk about fields. So I'm a theorist, I'm going to talk about fields, but the fields are the operators that can create and destroy the particles. So you can go either way. Okay, so there's a field for the electron, too. In electrodynamics, we like things with charges. Electrons have charges. And in that case, it's not a four-vector A mu. It's actually a spinner field. In quantum mechanics, spin-a-half particles form Pauli spinners. And this field, actually, it destroys an electron, but it creates an anti-electron or a positron. It's not a real field. It's not Hermitian. It's psi dagger that destroys the positron, its Hermitian conjugate, and creates the electron. And because it's got electron and positron and the two spins, you can put it in a four-component object, or you can separate out the different types of spins, or helicities is the actual word, and use two-component objects. So the electron transforms under a phase transformation, under these gauge transformations. And if this was a constant, well, if you repeat two phase transformations, you get a phase transformation. If I use minus omega, that's the inverse of this. And so these phases form a group, which is called the U1 group. And so sometimes the U1 group, you could have constant omega from that. And so sometimes you describe electromagnetism as the theory that results from gauging the group of transformations U1. There is an analog of F mu nu for size. If I want to construct a Lagrangian, I want kinetic terms, I want some derivatives on size. But d mu psi, because I can differentiate this, is not invariant under gauge transformation, so it's hard to make invariants. So what you do is you construct a covariant derivative, and then when this hits this, it brings down an omega that's canceled out by this, and so d mu psi transforms the same way as psi, and so I can construct a gauge invariant, for example, by psi dagger d mu psi. It's easy. And then you just have to worry about removing the indices, contracting them somehow, because you want it to be Lorentz invariant as well. Transforms a Lorentz vector. And that you use the Dirac gamma matrices for that. OK, so that's electromagnetism in a nutshell. That's how you build it. That's the principles involved. And as I mentioned before, the gauge group is U1. So what's the standard model? It's based on the following gauge group. U1. That's phase transformations. You could view them as a matrix, a one-by-one matrix, kind of pathetic matrix, so it's not much point saying that. SU2 is the group of 2x2 unitary matrices with determinant 1. It takes three parameters to specify all the elements in that group, three real parameters. We can gauge that group as well, and those three parameters become the three gauge bosons that you need to gauge that group. And then there's the group, so the weak interactions on electromagnetism live in here, in a way I'll show you. And color is the SU3 group, 3x3 special unitary matrices, 8 colored gluons, G, the W plus minus Z in photon. These are all the gauge bosons. We don't see these gluons. They're supposed to be massless as degrees of freedom, but we don't see massless particles there because they're confined inside of hadrons, like protons and neutrons. And there's energy of confinement. So So we don't see any massless degrees of freedom. The masses of the W and Z are about this. So that's the gauge principle. What's the standard model? Here it is. You know, I think every talk I've ever given, I have the next. It's really embarrassing, actually, now that I think about it. But that's it. That's the standard model. That is the complete story. I don't have to tell you absolutely anything more for you to construct the standard model if you go home. That's your last problem set in my class. Maybe it's your first problem set. I'm not sure. What have I got on this? I've got the fields, up quarks, down quarks, left-handed, right-handed up quark, right-handed down quark, left-handed doublet. This contains neutrino and electron. The doublet's under the SU2. This is how SU2 transforms, doublets. These have color. They're triplets under color. These don't have any color. There's I. I is a label. There's three kinds of each. Don't ask me why. I have no idea why. It's a complete embarrassment. I don't know. Nobody knows. We've tried to understand that. We surrendered. I wish I had a white flag. I'd put it on the hockey stick and wave it like that. But someone, some younger person, will figure out why, and then we'll all feel embarrassed. There's probably a reason why. And then stuck at the end is this Higgs in red. It doesn't look like red, but it's supposed to be in red. It's really important, the Higgs. It's got no color. It's an SU2 doublet. It's got hypercharge a half. And all of these are fermions. And this is the, in other words, they're spin a half. And this is, the gauge bosons have spin one. And this is the only thing with spin zero. And we put it in. Steve Weinberg stuck it in when he built the theory. Because otherwise it didn't make any sense. So what do we do from this table? This is really true. From this you construct the standard model. You just write down every possible interaction you can write down amongst these degrees of freedom. That's invariant local interaction. So we like locality as a principle. That's invariant under Lorentz transformations and the gauge transformations. And then you stop. Well, unfortunately, that'll take you your whole lifetime because there's an arbitrary number of such operators. But then you look at the dimensions of their coupling constant. And you stop when the coupling constants start to have dimensions of inverse mass. Because then you imagine in the back of your mind that that mass is big. And so the impact of that on present-day experiments is small. And so you can neglect those operators. And then you get down to a finite number, just a few operators. And that's really what we call the standard model. Don't have to say anything more. Don't have to talk about this and that to get rid of this and that. You just write it all down. You fit the parameters to experiment. There's about 26 parameters. OK, that's not so great. But it all works, almost. The way I've described it here, it doesn't have any neutrino masses. And it doesn't have a particle to be the dark matter. You can put neutrino masses in some ways. And there's a gazillion ways to try to put something in that's the dark matter that aren't as well motivated as the neutrino case. But we do need more than this, but I'm going to call this the standard model. So how's the Higgs fit in? Well, the Higgs fits in because if I stuck to this gauge principle, which I'm using to build the standard model, the W plus minus Z would be massless, and they got to have a mass. So you put in this potential by hand. Well, everything's by hand. These are the only allowed operators for the in the scalar that you can get. If I went to h dagger h cubed, then this coefficient would have dimensions of 1 over mass squared. And so I'm going to imagine it's small. I'm going to neglect it. And then you look for the ground state. If I pick this to be a negative number, this has dimensions of mass mu h. This is dimensionless. Then we can try to minimize this. Look for the ground state. If I look at the kinetic terms for the Higgs, they want the ground state to be constant in space. And so you get a minimum here. You can always choose it to be in this and not this by a gauge transformation. And you can fit VH squared to parameters in the theory. And actually, VH squared is basically just the value of Fermi's constant, so it's very well measured. And this breaks the SU2 cross U1 to a U1 subgroup. This is electromagnetism, and it actually lies a little bit in here and a little bit in here, so the original U1 is not electromagnetism. That's the potential for the Higgs. The next thing you look at is its gauge invariant kinetic energy. So remember, it's a column vector. These are matrices. This multiplies the matrix 1. This is the hypercharge a half on the other plot. This is the kinetic energy. You put H equal to this, VH over 2, And you can see that then this gives you something that's just quadratic in the gauge fields with no derivatives if I set this to zero. And that's mass terms. And it does give mass to the W plus and minus and Z. The Higgs must be a doublet under SU2. There's other representations of the group that you could write down, but they don't give you the right mass ratio for the W and Z. It's got to be a doublet to get the right mass. To understand the properties of the Higgs boson, you say, well, I'm not just in the ground state. I can excite particles. So you write H naught as VH plus H. It ends up the charge component here you can always remove by a gauge transformation, so that's not a physical degree of freedom. It's went into the extra spin component of these particles when they get a mass. They have three spin components, not just the two helicities for a photon. And this parameter, MH, is equal to mu H. And so if you want to know how the Higgs couples, you just take a look at wherever this vacuum expectation value occurred and take it out and replace it by H over V. And that tells you how the Higgs couples. So obviously it couples to two W's and two Z's in a way proportional to their mass. The quarks and leptons get a mass through a similar mechanism. You can't write down a mass term if you look at the Lagrangian, but you can write down a term that couples those fields to the Higgs field, and then when the Higgs gets a VeV, they get mass. And so the Higgs couples to the quarks and leptons. When you look at those mass terms, they give you a mass matrix. It's not diagonal. You have to diagonalize it to get the eigenstates that have a definite mass. It just involves a mishmash of up charm, top, and down strange bottom, and linear combinations. Automatically, when you do that, the Higgs will couple diagonally to the quarks. It'll couple up to up, charm to charm, top to top, not to up to charm, electron to electron, not electron to muon. And we say that the Higgs couplings, that there's no flavor-changing neutral currents. That's how we characterize the things that would change, in quotes, the flavor, the different types of the objects. There's extremely strong constraints on flavor-changing neutral currents, from things like mu to E conversion, the parameter epsilon that I mentioned before. They're very strong constraints. But this Higgs automatically satisfies it. Okay, this is the minimal standard model, sort of stuck in by hand. Let's try to do some simple extensions of it. Well, what about two Higgs doublets? That's a pretty minimal type of extension, right? You know, give me a break. We could try that just to start. No, not as good. Doesn't work. Bad things happen. You get flavor-changing neutral currents at tree level if you just write down all the interactions. Very strong constraints on that. That other Higgs would have to be quite heavy to be compatible with data. Of course, you can not have this problem. You can mumble this and that and not have the problem, but then you can't describe the whole theory by a single picture with representations, not as good as the standard model. A Higgs with a mass of about 125 g, that's fine for what we call precision electroweak experiments. When you have this standard model, you make predictions at higher orders in perturbation theory, properties of the W and Z. That's called precision electroweak physics, and the Higgs with a mass in that range, that's fine. You know, if you ask the best Higgs mass to fit that data, it's somewhat lighter, but it's certainly consistent with all of that data. So often you'll hear in popular talks that, I don't know why people do this, given by, you know, physicists, that they'll talk that, you know, the mass in the universe, the Higgs is responsible for the mass in the universe. I think particle physicists have astrophysics envy. They like to mention the universe. So, you know, I want to dispel that rumor right away, that there's no truth to that. There might be some, but as far as I know, there's no truth. If you look at the mass of the universe, not the energy, what we call dark energy is most of the energy, then there's about 25% with this dark matter. Who knows if the Higgs has anything to do with the dark matter mass? We don't know. Okay, let's look at the stuff we know about that's got mass. It's mostly protons and neutrons, right? It's where most of the mass lives. You got electrons in you. Believe me, you're mostly protons and neutrons. That's where most of your mass lives. Well, the proton does not get most of its mass from the Higgs getting a vacuum expectation value. The quarks do, the up and down quarks, but that's only about 1% of the mass of the protons and neutrons. They get most of their mass from the strong interaction effect. So next time you're at a talk and a particle physicist says that, throw something at him or her. Okay, so that was a small rant. Sorry about that. Not supposed to rant during my colloquium. Can't help it. Okay, Well, we know there's some new physics beyond the Standard Model. Where might we find it? But we're going to go look for it. So the first thing you should do is take experiment. Write down one of these operators with a coupling suppressed by mass squared, and find the limit on how small that coupling mass has to be, how large that mass has to be. So where's the best limit come from? Well, it comes from this operator here and a few others like it. Up quark, down quark, electron field. So if you take a proton, this could destroy two of the up quarks in the proton. It could create an anti-down. You can combine the down with the anti-down, this anti-down with the down in the proton to make a pi zero. And then this can create a positron. So you'll get proton decay through this decay mode. Well, they look for proton decay. If I characterize the coupling constant in front of this term, the Lagrangian, as 1 over lambda squared, where this has dimensions of mass, you look at the limits on looking for proton decay in this mode, it tells you that that mass is greater than 10 to the 16 JeV. Well, that's a real upgrade on the LHC energy. So if we have to wait to that energy scale for finding the physics beyond the Standard Model, if you're a particle physicist and not inclined to work on quantum gravity, then it's time to head for the beach and enjoy the sunshine, because we're just never going to know. Of course, this is only one operator. It could be that the scale of new physics associated with the violation of baryon number, which this violates, is some very high scale. But other things happen at a lower scale that conserves baryon number. So let's step away from this and make a more theoretical argument. And this argument is sometimes called the hierarchy puzzle. So what you do is you look at the Higgs mass and perturbation theory. And you go beyond leading order and perturbation theory. So leading order, it's got some, actually, for technical reasons that I don't want to discuss, it's really the mass squared for scalars that's the appropriate variable. So it's got some value at leading order and perturbation theory, MH naught squared. I called the naught because it's leading order, zeroth order. And then you add in the corrections from higher order involving these intermediate sums, which are integrations over momenta. And let's just cut that off at some scale, lambda, some momentum scale, where we're not sure what should go in there anymore because we haven't done experiments there. So then you get a relation like this. And it depends on whether it's a Fermion or a boson, whether it's plus minus. Here I did two intermediate top quarks, so I actually know the sign, but I just called it plus or minus to keep it general because different types of particles can give you either plus or minus. This is about 1. The coupling, this is about 10 to the minus 2. If I put a TeV here, 1,000 GeV, I get 10 to the 6. 6 minus 2 is 4. That's about the measured mass of the Higgs square. Looks pretty normal. But what if I put in here 10 to the 16th JeV? Then I got a ginormous number here. I need another ginormous number here to cancel against it to give this tiny number. And you know, most people, when they see that, it just looks loony. And that's the hierarchy puzzle. We want a theory where this doesn't look loony. And I think the best candidate for a theory that does this, has this cancellation, is, of course, there's some prejudice involved in this, is low-energy supersymmetry, SUSY. And low-energy supersymmetry does the job, but in supersymmetry, for every boson, you have a fermion that's degenerate with it. OK, that's not going to work, right? There's no scalar charge minus 1 degenerate with the electron. So you have to spontaneously break the symmetry, or explicitly, but you can do that. We know how to spontaneously break symmetries. Our condensed matter colleagues taught the particle physicists how to do it. Supersymmetry, if it manifests itself, well, what happens here is that this lambda gets cut off by a mass squared difference between the supersymmetry partner and the particle. So for a top, it would be something you might call a stop scalar. And it becomes a finite number. So as long as those masses are 10 to the 3 GeV or less, it looks normal. That's how supersymmetry is supposed to solve the problem. It is a little awkward, supersymmetry. One of the reasons it's awkward is because the Higgs comes out lighter than this 125 GeV. It comes out lighter because this parameter lambda H is actually fixed in supersymmetry to be related to a gauge coupling. And when you work it out, fixing VH by G Fermi, it means the Higgs has to be lighter. So that's in the simplest types of models. You can make a more complicated model add some more particles beyond those there, and you can get it to work. But the simplest things don't work for that reason. Well, yeah? I'm getting there. Yeah. So, what about lambda equals 10 to EV? That's pretty depressing if you're an experimentalist working at the LHC. Pretty tough to see particles with masses greater than that unless they had a really spectacular decay signature. You know, even far into the future. That's pretty, what would that give us? Well, this is a very crude argument, but in this crude argument, this would give us a 1% fine tuning. Well, maybe that's okay, right? 1%. Maybe it's not okay. It depends. This is a qualitative argument. But if you think 1% is not okay, I'd like to remind you of the following thing. I took this out of a recent paper that appeared on the archive, but I did the author a favor by not giving the reference. No, it's actually okay. I mean, it just points out this coincidence. Jeez, I'm being recorded. I kept forgetting. I'm sorry. Okay, anyways. If you take the measured values of mz, and it's an interesting thing to point out. It's a good paper. Mz, mt, divided by mh squared, you get 1.002 plus or minus 0.01. 1% accident. Stuff happens. So I don't know. Maybe it could be 10 to EV. This would be a 1% accident. This is probably an accident. And it's a 1% accident. What can you say? Makes you a bit nervous. I'm nervous. But I'll still go on, showing great courage at this point. Here's another thing that might make you nervous about hierarchy problem. The cosmological constant is another parameter in your theory. It usually goes under the name dark energy. It's because my astrophysical colleagues are like geniuses. You know, if you call something dark energy, the funding pours in. If you call it the cosmological constant, what do you get? Like a nickel. So, anyways, it's a cosmological constant. It's a coupling constant in your Lagrangian in front of an operator. What's the simplest operator you could write down? It's the operator 1. 1 is Hermitian. It doesn't do much in non-relativistic quantum mechanics or most of particle physics, because all it does is add a constant to the energy of every state. Usually we throw it away. If you read Shankar's book, I love that quantum mechanics book, I use it in my class, he tells you to throw it away, so you throw it away. But gravity feels everything. And so it affects the evolution of the universe. And it's got dimensions of mass to the fourth, so you'd make a similar argument like this. And now it's mass to the fourth, so if I put in a TeV, we've measured things up to a TeV, I get 12 here, minus 2, you add the bare value. Then you get this, the measured value is like 10 to the minus 47. I mean, that something's going up, something else going on there if you take these problems seriously. Stephen saw this and now it's given him like a. So I don't know what's going on. If we hadn't done experiments above an electron volt in energy, we'd say that supersymmetry was explaining this, or we might, but we can't anymore. I don't know what it is. If you live in California, there's a lot of discussion of the anthropic principle as one of the possible explanations, particularly in Northern California. But you know what they say about Californians? They're a bunch of loony type people. So I don't have anything more to say about it. I could elaborate on this argument if you'd like. I put it in kind of a small font because sometimes people find it offensive to discuss this, but I don't know. I think it's science, but kind of borderline. Okay, so then there's the WIMP miracle. This is not very strong evidence, so I stuck it at the end, and that's if you say that dark matter is weakly interacting and has a mass of around the weak scale, then you get the right density of dark matter in the early universe, and so it suggests there's new physics at the weak interaction scale. Unfortunately, if you say it interacts with ordinary matter with a weak interaction cross-section, it's way too big. It's already ruled out experimentally. So the validity of this argument has been greatly diminished by the dark matter searches. Okay, we finally made it. With 1 minute left, I'm going a bit over. What can you do to me? You can't cut my pay. I don't work here permanently. So I'm going to go over to discuss this. I want to say a little bit about beyond the standard model physics to give you a feeling of what's going on. So we're going to focus on physics at the weak scale, because that's where it has a chance of impacting the properties of the Higgs boson. And I want to give you a sense of what's going on. So the first thing I'm going to add is something with color. I want to add something with color, because then at the LHC, you make a lot of it. A color means it has strong interactions. So we make a lot of it. I'm going to choose something that has no weak interactions, no SU2 across U1 quantum numbers. So it's got charge zero. But it's got to be, it can't couple to quarks and leptons through these renormalizable interactions that I mentioned before, the ones with coupling constants that don't have dimensions with 1 over mass. But it can decay still through such interactions if it's a color octet. That's the lowest dimensional representation, 8. Because then you can add a term in its potential that involves 3 of these O's, making it invariant. And then when you do higher orders in perturbation theory, it decays to 2 gluons. Let's just add it to the theory. Then it can couple. It's pair produced at the LHC, similar to the Higgs, except at a much bigger rate. At tree level, gluons come in and they make two of these octets. And it also has an allowed term in the Lagrangian that couples to the Higgs like this. And so when one of these gets an expectation value, and for the other one you pick out the Higgs H, it can couple to these 2 octets, and they can be intermediate states in perturbation theory and materialize as final state gluons. So they can affect the Higgs to glu-glu vertex. And if you look at that backwards, that's the glu-glu to Higgs vertex, which is the production rate for Higgses at the LHC. So if you look at the LHC, they not only found the Higgs, they looked for other stuff, a lot of stuff. And generically, I'm not talking, there'll be exceptions to this depending on how things decay, but generically the limits are around 600 GeV. For colored particles, a little bit higher for this octet scalar. Yeah? So it's pretty hard to make a. I'd have to have a more complicated theory. People have studied that and the limits on those, but you know, I want it to, for my own personal reasons, I want it to be a renormalizable theory. If it's a massive spin one, then I need a little more machinery in the model to get that mass. But it's a possibility. People have studied it. Sometimes they're called colorons, the particles that you're talking about, and there's limits on those, which are about 800, 700 GeV. If they decay to 2 jets, that's the limit. If you have other ways that they decay, the limit might be different. Yeah, thank you. Good question. So okay, so what happens with this? We're interested mostly in how it influences the Higgs production rate here. So what do you do? So there's a formalism for this where it's called integrating out. These things that only occur in intermediate states in perturbation theory, you can remove those particles and replace them by these non-renormalizable interactions that characterize them. So you can pick a gluon and a gluon out of these field strength tensors for the gluon and a Higgs out of here. Well, what's the upshot of this? The upshot is you can calculate in this model the C sub G, and it involves this coupling, something like this, a mass. When all is said and done, if the coupling lambda is something like 1, then it's about a 1% effect on the Higgs production rate. That's very small. That's well within the errors, probably smaller than the theoretical uncertainty in the Higgs production rate. So the moral of the story from this, as far as the Higgs goes, is there's lots of room for color particles with masses at a TeV or greater. Still around the weak scale, the scale that might be associated with the solution to the hierarchy puzzle, but there's room for them. The limits on particles that don't have color, they're produced at much lower rates. They're not nearly as stringent at the LHC. So let's look at some of their impact. I should mention also that this colored particle, it didn't have any electromagnetic charge, so it wouldn't affect gamma-gamma at all. So let's put something in the loop that might affect gamma-gamma, just to get a sense of that, since it was brought up earlier. Should I take that seriously? So here's a model I actually worked on a long time before I came up with a model. I'm not going to describe you the all structure, but in this model, it had vector-like leptons. So they're not the standard model leptons. I called them L prime and double prime, left and right. That's why it's called vector-like. It's mirrored. Everything left has right, electrons left and right, and also the neutrinos right, and left. So they're all mirrored. We're going to assume that these leptons only get mass through coupling to the Higgs, so you pair them up in the usual way. Maybe they get tiny masses from another mechanism. Let me not say that. Let's just neglect that if they do. They all get mass from the Higgs. And let's say those masses, the limits are only around 100 GeV. Let's say those masses are around 100, 200 GeV. Well, that's ruled out, because those would reduce the branching ratio for Higgs to gamma-gamma by about a factor of 3. Remember, there was a slight excess, if anything. So that's actually ruled out. So the data on the Higgs, it's pretty powerful for things that have masses below the TeV scale, a few hundred GeV scale. Of course, that's not to say that these particles are ruled out. I assume that all of their mass comes from coupling to the Higgs. If they had other sources of their mass, a bare mass term, then you could make this much smaller. The coupling to the Higgs could be smaller. And there's even regions of parameter space where you increase the branching ratio to gamma-gamma beyond its standard model value. So there's room for changes in the properties of the Higgs from new physics at scales around the weak scale, a few hundred GeV, or a couple of hundred GeV from particles that don't have color. I didn't talk about here changing the branching ratio for Higgs to BB bar or tau plus and tau minus. You can also do that from physics at the weak scale. The problem with that is that when you do that, you often get additional flavor-changing neutral currents. These things that I mentioned were bad, and you often have to say a little bit more to remove that. But if you're willing to say that a little bit more, you can do that. You want to hear a little bit about the radion? It's your call. Okay, so the Randall-Sundrum model. Well, the Randall-Sundrum model is a remarkably clever idea. It's kind of shocking, actually. So they say, let the space-time have one extra dimension. That extra dimension is like a line. And stuck on the end of the line are two surfaces, four-dimensional space-time surfaces. We live on one of them. This is the simplest version of their model. All the degrees of freedom that we know and love, the stuff we're made of, the photons, they all, except for the graviton. The graviton's all-knowing, goes everywhere. But they live on just one of the surfaces. And the extra dimension, it has a negative cosmological constant, and it's got a size of about 60 Planck lengths across, a little bit larger than the Planck length. That's a model that, for reasons I can't discuss in the amount of time I have here, actually would solve the hierarchy problem. Now, it's not like SUSY. It's not a complete, in quotes, theory, the way supersymmetry is. So it's more like a scenario. More like a scenario, if you'd like. But could be the way nature works. Okay, so I told you the size of the space is like 60 Planck lengths across. That's pretty small. Can't sweep your dust into that. It's not very big. But that 60 is important because it's that 60 that it ends up appearing in an exponential, and it's what solves the hierarchy problem, gives you a light Higgs. There's a particle associated with stabilizing the size of that space-time. It's called the radion. And it ends up that it's not so hard to have the radion. So if you have an extra dimension, every particle that you have, it has excitations called Kaluza-Klein excitations, more massive ones, that imitate it in much of its properties, except they're more massive. So you can look for those Kaluza-Klein excitations. And limits on that are at the TeV scale. But there is a particle that's not one of those. It's associated with the dynamics that stabilizes the space-time at that large size. And it ends up that having that somewhat lighter than this TeV scale, something around 125 G, is not unreasonable. Sort of kind of happens without doing a lot of bad things. And that radion, I called it R, it couples to the trace of the stress tensor. And this trace, it has a lot of nice properties. For example, for a photon involving f mu nu, it's in the stress tensor, of course. Photons can carry energy, but I cancel out in the trace. And that suppresses the branching ratio to two photons. Remember, it's only a 0.2% branching ratio. And the W and Z are here with roughly the right level. So this kind of works. You don't have to do too many horrible things to get this to work. But there's absolutely no reason for f to have the right value, this 1 with plus or minus 0.4 or 0.3, that was measured. It should be of order 1. Could be 10, could be smaller, but so close to 1, there's no reason. So as that gets better, it disfavors things like this. But if you're interested in this scenario, it's not the radion. That's not the signature you're looking for, and that's not the one that the LHC experimentalists are focusing on. They're really focusing on these Kaluza-Klein excitations, in particular the excitation to the of the graviton. And it couples to the stress tensor like this, just like the graviton does with some different F. And now this is you make very definite predictions for the various modes, gamma-gamma, ZZ, plus E minus, UU bar. The relative rates are this. So if they saw this, we would certainly know that it was this. And it would be one of the great discoveries in physics if it happened to be true. So here we are at slide 19. And the traditional thing is to finish off with a conclusion slide. But the story's not over. We're going to have at Christmas time new results released from ATLAS and CMS around Christmas time. And they're going to be better. And we're going to see what's going on. So this is an ongoing story. I hope I've given you some flavor of the issues. And of course, there's some of my prejudice went into the discussion of beyond the standard model physics, some sense of what's plausible, what's not plausible. And just stay tuned for the exciting developments as we go forward. Thank you.
So it's become traditional for the students to have first crack at questions. So are there any students that want to ask Mark some questions?
I was too clear on this.
You don't need to be shy. No, okay, well students can still ask questions, but now everyone else can ask questions too.
Can you comment on supersymmetry?
Yeah. So I said briefly, I mentioned it very briefly. So there's two aspects of supersymmetry. One is the Higgs mass that I mentioned before. Basically,
I'm particularly keen to learn what like the experiment has shed on minimal supersymmetry next to minimal.
Well, so let me try to find the right slide. Yeah. So what happens is that this lambda H is a term by quartic. So now we're talking minimal, Susie, the minimal particle content. So what happens is that this is a little bit smaller. So to fix VH, this has to be a little bit smaller, and you end up with a Higgs mass less than 125 GeV. So we can get around that. Here's some mechanisms out there. One is to add a singlet. It's got a somewhat strongish coupling to make it work, but that's sometimes called the next to minimal Susie because you've just added a singlet. Another way is to add a fourth generation of vector-like fermions. That idea is due to Steve Martin. You wouldn't think that the comedian was so versatile, but apparently he is. And there's probably other ways. So you have to make it a little more complicated than the minimal thing. Then there's the issue, if you just look at the parameters in the Lagrangian and look at the various masses, it looks like you want them to be around 100 GeV without involving tunings. But those parameters are all things that don't involve color. And so you might want some of them to be lighter. Then there's various different scenarios. So you might want to have a light stop to help with this fine-tuning problem. This is pretty crude. The numbers are actually different than this. And it involves somewhat of a fine-tuning if you go all the way up to a TeV. It ends up that a light stop between around 150 and 250 GeV is not ruled out just because of how it decays. And then you'd have the supersymmetric partners of the lighter generations heavier. So, you know, it's sort of an ongoing story. I don't consider it particularly near to being ruled out by the present data or
or not particularly attractive based on the particular, you know, we guessed, we put the minimal thing in. But I'll tell you what makes me most nervous about it is I would have hoped we would just would have seen a hint of it, right? You know, here's a sort of the joke about about supersymmetry. We've almost confirmed it. We've seen evidence for every multiplet, every supermultiplet. But we've seen the standard model particle of every supermultiplet. The superpartner of every one is missing. So, you know, it leaves you not feeling so good.
Do any of these extensions help with the 2-gamma?
You could make the vector-like leptons help if you gave them a mass, just a bare mass term, and certain regions of parameter space, they could help. It's pretty easy to push that out with things that don't have color and are not ruled out by the LHC. It's very easy. So I want that's why I put that example
but
in.
But the next minimal one is when you have to scale it.
So in SUSY,
yeah.
You're asking.
Yeah.
So I don't know if the next to minimal one pushes it up. I haven't really looked at that in detail. My sense is there's enough particles in there, especially if you allow arbitrary soft breakings, that you're going to be able to get this heavier. I think with a vector-like fourth generation, you could push it up. I'm pretty sure about that, which is Steve Martin, a comedian. I'm sorry. Not really. Not the same Steve Martin. Yeah, so that's the status. We're just going to have to wait. I'm nervous, but I'm mostly nervous because I would have thought we would have seen a super partner already, something just hanging around for us to see. I would have liked the minimal, one of the minimal ones to be right. I got prejudices, mostly related to papers I've written. The worst type of prejudice you could have as a theorist, but I think those are gone.
Yeah, you didn't mention one of the oldest ideas, which is that the Higgs is a composite, either top, anti-top, or technicolor.
Yeah, so those models just seem so complicated to me, so hard to get
to
work compared to the standard model, that I put a little theoretical prejudice in there. So if the simplest of composite models is technicolor. And there it has all kinds of problems with flavor change and neutral currents, and you can tune yourself to be near fixed point and push that scale up, but you know, if you try to build something realistic with everything in there, it's not like this one page I stuck up there. So I think that this is really my prejudice. I think if you ask most of the theoretical community, they would not share this prejudice with me, that those things are, they like them. That just seems to me not right. You know, if nature pushes me that way, I'll jump on the bandwagon.
But the LHC, has the LHC further constrained those models at all?
It constrains them somewhat, but they're not ruled out by that. In fact, this dilaton is partly composite. Randall Sundrum, you can view that as a composite model. I have a joke for that. Want to hear my joke? What choice do you have now? So, there's another way to view the Randall Sundrum model, not as an extra dimension, but has some composite model. And they're actually equivalent points of view. You can view it one way or the other. So let's say we confirm that the Randall Sundrum model is correct. And now we found it experimentally. Now you want to go and explain it to your Congress man or woman to get more funding. So you've got two choices. You can describe it as a strongly coupled, almost informal theory that you've discovered, or you've discovered an extra dimension for space. I'm often for the latter, and that's why I described it that way at the top. But as an example of a composite model. There was another question down here.
I was just going to ask exactly about that.
Okay. So one of the interesting consequences of the measured value of X is if you extrapolate the potential of a large band, ours is not the lowest energy.
Right, so I should have talked, I debated whether to talk about that. So our vacuum is unstable, there's a lower vacuum at large field values. It takes a very long time to tunnel to it, so we're not at risk it's not like we should head to the bar downstairs tonight and drink heavily, although I intend to do that, because the world's going to end tomorrow. But you can change that, actually. If you add new physics at higher scales, it can turn it up. But if you just have the minimal standard model, it's actually a pretty amazing thing. That is the situation we're in. It's, we're living in an unstable vacuum on borrowed time.
Okay, I can see that nobody wants to ask a question after that answer. So let's thank Mark again.